Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, COO of ExchangeWire, joined here in the studio today by our special guest, Ron Amron, Global Media Lead from Heineken. Welcome, Ron.
Thank you for having me.
Not at all. Our pleasure. And joined also by our head of content at ExchangeWire, Lindsay Browntree. How are you doing, Lindsay?
Really well. How are you?
That's good. I'm very well, thank you.
Relaxed, I guess.
I've been away on holiday. So, and you had to put up with Kieran while I was gone. Had that go, Lindsay.
Yeah, that was great fun. Really wonderful time.
There was a bit of ranting, I noticed, on last week's podcast.
Of course, there was ranting.
Kieran's favourite thing to do is rant.
Yeah.
Yeah, this will be a much more nuanced conversation. Predictions. Okay, so let's dive into the news stories for the week. First news story I wanted to chat about with the both of you was some publishers reporting seeing an uplift from Apple News. So this is quite interesting because it's long been touted by publishers as not really providing any revenue uplift, well recognized for sort of brand recognition, but not that good in delivering revenue uplift results for publishers. This is an article that appeared in DigiDay and sort of suggested that it's possible from the number of publishers that they spoke to who were seeing a little bit of a revenue uplift, that it's possible that this could be to do with advertisers flocking to this environment because it's very privacy safe, and also because the targeting that's offered is perhaps a little more granular and contextual. And I guess one wonders whether that might become a little more popular in the wake of the relevance of the third-party cookie declining somewhat. So I'm interested to know what your perspective is on this. Ron, let's start with you. What did you make of this news story?
Yeah, I think advertisers are wondering why it's not more prevalent within the Google, you know, DSP world to find Apple News content. I think it's because they've been very limited in the amount of inventory they've been putting on the platform, and they're only now, I think they're testing it. I think they're almost testing the relationship with Google. There are lots of theories probably why it really hasn't scaled, but it, potentially now it will. Hmm. So hopefully, you know, I think we're all looking for good quality inventory in a world where there's a lot of bad stuff out there. So you know, this is one that everyone's been discussing for a while, and you know, Apple has kind of come and gone with, you know, being ad supported and selling ad space. But hopefully, this is an opportunity now for us to find good mobile content, brand safe, high quality inventory. And what I would also love is if they put it on other DSPs as well. But
yeah,
for me, I'm not surprised, but I think it's just surprising how long it's taken for them to open this up.
So maybe it just feels like it's been a slow burn, but actually now we're starting to see some results. And it's interesting because I think it was on last week's podcast, wasn't it? You guys were talking about Apple needing to rely on something outside of the hardware business.
We were, the services business.
That's right.
Which Apple News makes up a proportionate part.
Yeah. So what's your perspective, Lindsay?
I think it's interesting to me the jump that these publishers are talking about. So the likes of The Stylist and Vice Media are talking about 145% increases in revenue in the space of just a month. So it tells me that Apple have done something. Apple have either, I've been going to publishers and getting them to switch something on, like, because the way that it works, you either have direct sold or you have backfill or you have pulled. They've been saying, like, you know, stop trying to work with us direct sold. It's not going to work for you. Turn on your backfill, kind of like switch your ads to backfill so that, you know, we can actually there be more inventory available,
yep.
Which I think publishers have been reticent to do before because Apple take 30% of the cut. But actually, if direct sold is such a small part of the channel, because Apple News is still quite small, it's still not the biggest news aggregator or the biggest news source in the UK, a publisher isn't going to work with direct sold if it requires so much resource for such a small amount of revenue. Actually, maybe there is a value to, you know, it's not all the revenue, but it is still some revenue to getting Apple to do a lot of the work for you, taking 30% of the cut, you still get 70% of that, which is more revenue you get before. So I feel like Apple have done something to either the advertiser side, they've been, you know, making more impressions available, or going and speaking to publishers and saying, like, fix this. Like, you can do this. There's more revenue available on the table.
Or maybe a little of both.
Yeah, but absolutely. Like, telling advertisers there's an opportunity here for you guys to be, there's you know, we're a cookieless environment. Most of our traffic is iOS, is mobile as well. So we've got great targeting solutions. You know, you can comfortably buy it. You have to use Workbench, but you can comfortably buy it through Ad Manager or through Display Manager. There's opportunity here. And then on the flip side, telling publishers, advertisers are going to start coming. Make sure you're ready for this. And they're seeing the uplift.
Maximize your opportunities here.
But part of this also, I mean, it's just pricing. I think if Apple keeps throwing a heavy margin on this inventory, it will not sell in a DSP world. So I do think that that's potentially what you're saying is that, you know, there has to be some truth to it. If they've been out there really for a little while, so they've had to probably adjust pricing. They may have had to go back and forth with the publishers on it.
I reckon they probably, I think there's something to that, definitely.
It's a guess.
Yeah. Everything has to be speculated. Yeah.
Because that's 30% fee. So that applies in this context as well. I thought it might have just been to Apple News Plus, which is the subscription version. No. It's across both.
And if you're a publisher, the way that you work with Apple News readers and Apple News Plus subscribers can be slightly different.
Yep.
But if you're asking Apple to work with you on backfill, then they take 30%.
Yeah.
You can go down a direct sell route.
Yeah.
But from what publishers are saying, it's not worth it for the margins you get. Like, it could require a whole person, and that whole person to kind of manage that one channel, the revenue you get off the back of it is not enough.
Just not going to be fruitful enough.
But maybe in long term, like at the moment, you know, at the moment maybe there's not much to it. At the moment it's kind of, well, let's watch this space, see what happens with Apple. Advertisers could start flocking there. But if they do start to come, then both advertisers need to kind of think of Apple as the next place where they can get safe inventory that is compliant. And publishers need to think, you know, advertisers are going to start coming here. We need to prepare ourselves and get tooled up for this. So it could be somewhere that, you know, a year down the line, direct sold actually does become a thing, and publishers do start actually dedicating people in their sales teams to Apple News only.
And what do you think about the compelling nature of the environment from an advertiser perspective, Ron? I mean, you mentioned it already. Do you think advertisers are going to, you know, your perspective is finally, do you think other advertisers will be feeling the same way?
Yeah, I do. I think it's a clean environment. It's safe environment, high quality content, right? So it's a very curated list of publishers, right? So I think from an advertiser's perspective, in a world where there's a tremendous amount of just clutter and waste out there, and potentially even nefarious kind of bad content for brands, it's a pretty safe, comfortable, quality place. So that to me is quite compelling. But the issue is obviously, is it priced well? Is there enough inventory and scale there? And is there enough information to say, all right, we're going to build reach and be very targeted, right? So the information is also critical, and that's part of what I think in the past has held things back. But in a world of GDPR, maybe this is a better way to go from a contextual perspective.
Yeah,
because I also wonder how much this is coming direct from advertisers as well that are buying Apple directly versus coming from the agencies, because Apple has historically been quite a difficult channel to buy through. It's not particularly scaled. Like, they don't make it particularly easy, that the inventory isn't really available. So a lot of people just go, you know what, for what I'm getting in return, while there might be a higher quality user there, I actually can't be bothered. And buying through Safari, particularly with ITP, becomes even more challenging. Why would I bother? But if they're speaking directly to the advertisers here and saying, this is brand safe, this is transparent, this is how you become compliant, versus the agencies that are going, is this the easiest route for me? Probably not, so I'm not going to maybe bother. But the advertisers will go, I don't care, because this is what I actually need and this is where I need to be appearing. So I'm not sure, again, where they're having conversations.
Where the push is coming from. That would be really interesting if it was coming directly from advertisers, and if people were sort of instructing their agencies to assist in this, it would say something about the sort of compelling nature of it and also the ease.
I mean, from my understanding, I would be surprised if it was direct, though. I think it's mostly just massive, you know, through DSPs, right?
Right.
So through Google, right? So I don't.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But they have, you know, they don't have a sales force anymore. They're relying on the legacy DoubleClick kind of sales product for them. So I don't know. But I don't know if it's agency or client direct or, you know, advertiser direct. But it's probably a blend of both.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, let's move on to the second news story of the week, which is focusing on marketing agency in the US, Ginlane, who have closed their doors to instead pivot and become a DTC holding company, which they're calling Pattern. And this is a really interesting move because they're going to structure this holding company around consumers rather than products. So they are building sort of brands, but from a product first perspective, the idea being that, you know, this is, by the way, the marketing agency that was behind establishing DTC brands like Harry's, and there was another couple of ones as well. And the idea being that they've learnt quite a lot, obviously, from that process, and they've gotten quite close to these digitally native brands and understood how they've built and grown their brand and their product. And they're using that learning to develop their own company, which will roll out products, you know, suitable to consumers. So I'm interested to know, particularly, Ron, what you think about this from a brand marketer advertiser perspective, because it seems to me to be you know, kind of fashionable. We're talking a lot, obviously, about DTC brands, but we're talking about how those businesses are being built and grown, and how they achieve scale, how they differ to legacy brands, but also where there might be some similarities. And also we're seeing, I think, a bit of a trend in those sort of service providers, whether that's agencies, marketing agencies, or other types of agencies, and possibly even technology partners. We're seeing a bit of a fashion in those service partners getting close to the crux of how those DTC businesses have been have gotten established and been built, and sort of, you know, trying to turn that to their own trade somewhat. So is this something that we're going to see more of? Are we going to see those that are somewhere within the service layer and have got some expertise in supporting brands and advertisers turn their hand towards building something from a DTC perspective? Is it also a trend that we're going to see from a sort of brand perspective, where you start seeing brands developing their businesses based on based on consumers rather than products? What's your perspective on this?
Well, I mean, I'll start with the DTC trend, because that's not something that's going to slow down. I think you're going to see more and more of it, and for good reasons. Number one, in industries where the path to the consumer is layered and lots of margin is built in, a DTC type relationship actually makes things more efficient and easier for the consumer. And in some cases, it's not even about money. It's simply about ease of use and speed and simplicity, and consumers are willing to pay for that, right? So the route to the consumer is always quite complex. I mean, and I'll give you an example, even from Heineken, from the beer industry. You know, we are building direct-to-consumer businesses as well, whether it's home draft systems, so you have, you know, great draft beer in your house. We have the sub, and we can ship you, you know, high quality draft beers in small torps, and you'll come to your house, and it tastes as good as it does in a pub. That's a direct consumer business we have. We also now work with other companies, or even in some countries, have our own home delivery. So cold beer delivery, right? So if you we're not the only ones doing this, but if you know you want to, you don't have beer and you're having people over, you just click on an app and you can have beer in an hour delivered to your house. And that's not even true of beer, but it's true for food and everything. So convenience is incredibly, you know, in the world of e-commerce, it's become, you know, in the expectation that things are at your fingertips. And we can make that a reality, right? So DTC is not going away. It's going to accelerate. And I think that's, from my perspective, a trend that's potentially going to be a game changer in lots of different industries. Now, you know, specifically about marketing agencies and advertising agencies potentially switching to DTC, I mean, that's an unknown. In my personal perspective about Ginlane, I think it's just their experience and passion and interest. You know, agencies are people who if that's what their passion, interest, and experience is, then they're gonna pivot and make a change to their business model. DTC is growing. You know, the number of DTC companies in the United States alone, I think, you know, they're probably 20 or 30 with billion-dollar valuations in the New York area just by themselves, just by itself. And they said it's all mushrooming across Europe as well. So it's, this is not a trend that's going away. And I wouldn't be surprised if more agencies focused on this. But I just think this is one where if you have experience with it and have an idea, then you'll make the change.
And it's interesting because they also, the article mentioned that the sort of founders or the CEO of what was Gin Lane, now to be Patton, was talking a lot about their intention to build and create products based on a consumer community that they're building. You know, probably using social channels, but saying that they want to use those social channels less for a reliance on advertising and more for an ability to build and grow that community. And then they're going to be using that, as DTC brands do, to have that direct sort of consumer conversation to then feed into their product design and product development. So, like you say, perhaps fueled by personal interest and experience that they've had with, you know, helping brands like Harry's build and grow. But it's interesting to know, I think it's quite interesting to see them flesh out that particular angle. They also likened it to the sort of corner store of, generations ago, where they perhaps knew the owners of the corner store, knew all the people that lived in the neighbourhood, and when they walked in the door, they would come with a list of not just things that you buy from that shop, but things that they need, and they could probably get most of the things that they needed at that local convenience store. And they were saying that this is the way that they'd like to build DTC businesses, where you have a community of consumers, you learn from them what kind of products they want, and that helps you build and grow those products. But it also means that they can come to one place to get a variety of different products. What do you think about this, Lindsay?
I think this whole, they refer to it as direct with consumer rather than direct to consumer. I think it's... that's just another term, really. I think it all kind of means the same thing. I'm not buying a lot into it because it's largely the same thing. And what they're doing, I feel like they're trying to create something out of something, if you like, but also something out of nothing. They're just creating a direct-to-consumer umbrella company.
You could argue it's another marketplace, right?
As an agency, they probably thought, we've built all these brands for these people. Harry's just got bought for $1.37 billion. We had a massive part in creating that, and maybe we should do this ourselves. We've been creating brands for these massive, these startup companies that are now absolutely massive in the US. Actually, we can do this. We've got a lot of learnings here. We've had, have many years of practicing. We can make this ourselves.
Yeah.
And I understand the kind of the umbrella focus, and there are other DTCs out there that are doing similar things now. They're kind of creating sub brands or sister brands. I think Glossier is one, the makeup brand, that's doing something similar. From what they've learned from their core customer base here. Oh, I realise that all the people that buy makeup from me also, I think it's a pet brand, they also have pets. So we can now sell pet food.
Yeah.
Amazing. Hallelujah. So
not
I
something,
think there'll be
not
a lot
something
of...
Heineken have considered. People that have beer also have dogs. Let's deliver them some dog food along with their cold beer.
We'll stick to brewing, I think.
Can you brew dog food? I don't know, maybe, yeah, ferment dog food. There could be something to this.
I'm in marketing. I don't know if I am. It's not my area.
Yeah, fair enough.
Just take notes, Ron. Take them to HQ.
Go back with some ideas for them, yeah. But I do think it's actually a very interesting stance that an agency is doing this. I really do. But I think that the premise behind it, they're just trying to, I feel like it's just a bit headline grabbing with the direct with consumer stuff. But I do think it's an interesting idea because they do have a lot of expertise and could probably bring something to it. But branding and doing creative for a big brand is very, very different from actually running a direct consumer brand as well. Yeah. So that's where I think they haven't got the experience. They're getting the funding and people believe in them. But the next challenge for them will be, how they actually are able to then turn this into a profitable business.
Well, that was also interesting because you're right. They have got a wedge of funding, and they also said that they weren't in a hurry to build out and grow lots of different brands. And I'm thinking, is that because you don't quite know how to do it
yet?
Like you maybe have to just use that money.
Idea. I hope they have that because
so do I.
Yeah. So I'm assuming they have a couple of ideas, but I don't. The truth is they could bring people. They probably can surround themselves with the right people now if they do have that idea. But they're not, I'd like to think that I think they're a very smart group of people. So my guess is there is a big idea there. And his passion switched from brand building and advertising to you know, building a business. I think your initial thought of, wow, this is a great way to make a lot of money is probably, you know, it's not wrong, but I think he has a passion and interest in it. Mm. So I think that, and that's, you know, and he probably has seen, you know, behind the curtain on how this works and has, you know, these, they're, you know, they have the advantage of being extremely creative, and I think that helps. But, you know, it's, we'll see. Now, and I don't think we're going to see a lot of agencies do this, though, because I don't, because I think starting, you know, a startup and being an advertising agency, two different things.
Totally. Mm. Yeah. That's what will be really interesting, I guess, is to watch and see how they grow. And like you say, Ron, you know, it's perhaps too early days to tell. You imagine that there is the genesis of an idea behind that.
I really
you
hope so.
You want to hope so, don't you? But then the flip of that is the news that Nike, however you want to say it, they've bought Select Analytics Company to grow. This is to your point, Ron, about kind of what Heineken are doing with the DTC model, to grow their DTC model, because they realise that they have, and Adidas have been doing something similar, not buying MarTech just yet, but they realise that as a big manufacturer, they actually know their consumers better than the retailers they work with. So they're trying to be able to understand their consumers better. And if you look at the news of DTC, like I've got a Google alert on for DTC, so I get all this crap come through all day, every day. And it's, there's so many of these kind of big legacy manufacturers and brands are pumping money into their DTC model. Yeah. And that, I think, is the interesting thing. It's not just about these startups and Gin Lane, like Patton creating another startup. It's also about where DTC can go as a trend for every business out there.
Absolutely. And I mean, we'll get into that in the second part of the podcast in a bit more detail, because Ron, I know you're doing some interesting things at Heineken around that. But I was just reading this morning actually in the news about Zara, and it was to do with so high street fashion label for our US listeners. Do they have Zara in the US? Yes, surely.
I don't know.
Certainly South and Central America.
I don't know. I actually don't know. I mean, it's obviously huge here in Europe.
But massive. Yeah. Missing out on something, US listeners, if you don't have Zara. Anyway, they were talking about...
I'll have to Google that. Yeah.
They were talking about their CEO, who is very rarely... excuse me, pardon me. Their CEO is very rarely comes out in the news in the news to sort of quote on anything or get involved in too many press conferences, has started to become a lot more prominent in the media, talking about their desire to move to 100% sustainability. So that's the materials and the fabrics that they use for the fashion, but also managing and handling their entire supply chain. And it actually said in the article that they have started and probably been doing for the last couple of years, running a particular type of supply chain that is much tighter than is typically the case for a big retail high street fashion brand that is global and has a lot of stock, to the extent that they've reduced their stock significantly, and they're using data, in-store data, to determine how to do that. So they work out with their stores on a sort of day-by-day basis what's selling, how much of it's selling. That then gets communicated back to the manufacturer so they know whether to run more product lines on those particular items or not. And they really emphasise the direct connection between the data that's being pumped out through their store activity and presumably their online activity as well, and having that fed back quickly enough to influence how the supply chain manages the manufacturing and the processing and the design of new products. And they also talked about that with respect to design as well, so that they have a sort of team of people that are very agile and can kind of dial up the volume of stuff that they're making or down depending on how it's being consumed, so they don't have a whole lot of back stock that they have to put on sale, and also so that they don't have stuff that they've got to store everywhere and, you know, take up space and move around and all of that sort of stuff, which I thought was really interesting. You can see there's an absolute opportunity there
for technology solutions. The joke is, this is how every retail business should be run. It's just so obvious. But unfortunately, the dots don't connect. They don't connect when it comes to supply chain, when it comes to logistics, when it comes to understanding, getting in-store data, using your point of sale to understand kind of what customers are buying, how they're buying, when they're buying, who they are. Like, there's so much out there that needs to be connected, but it just doesn't exist yet. Yeah. And I do find it very, very funny that you know, we're having these conversations. I mean, it would put people like TK Maxx or TJ Maxx in the US out of business.
TJ Maxx? Yeah. I never knew that.
Yeah, TJ Maxx.
By the way, Zara's isn't you know.
You've been sitting there Googling. Excellent. Amazing. We can all
rest easy. Phew.
But if there's no overstock, like, that many companies would struggle without having, this is an interesting point. But I think that, this is what every company would dream of.
Yeah.
Being able to tie all these different lines together, but it's just so far away from being done. Zara can control much more of a supply chain than a retailer can that buys in products from different manufacturers.
Yes.
So they have that benefit, but outside of that.
Or if you're CPG and relying on grocery.
100%, yeah.
It's a totally different
must be
world,
ridiculous.
Right.
Yeah, it's very hard.
But it is interesting to consider how much of, you know, of the sort of new model of digitally native brands and DTC businesses, how much of that can then just be rolled over to traditional legacy brands to change the way that they're doing things. And, you know, I'm sure, Ron, you'll have a bit to say about that. Let's move on.
No pressure.
Yeah, exactly. Let's move on to the third news story for the week, which is about Pinterest's Q2 results. So Pinterest, this is only the second quarter since going public for Pinterest, and their Q2 results are excellent. And their stock has risen 12% off the back of that. They've had 62% year-on-year growth. Revenue projections for the full year are up to something like $1.1 billion, and they're currently at I think it was 261 million their Q2 revenue, and the majority of that has actually come from activity within the US. So things are looking good for Pinterest. What is interesting about this is their CEO attributes this success, which also it rolls over into growth in user numbers as well, to a diversification in their advertising offering and their advertising models. So they've got three particular strands that they're pushing. The first is they're getting increased spend on the platform from existing brands or CPGs that are rolling out new types of brands and products. They're adding new and emerging verticals and categories, which is obviously then extending the advertising possibilities there. And then they're also starting to get pots of spend and brand budget from small to medium businesses, digitally native brands and DTC businesses. They've also done quite a lot around their advertiser products, specifically geared towards the small and medium business-sized advertiser. So their self-serve platform and their analytics and tracking platform, they've designed specifically for the smaller advertiser. So they're doing a lot around building their advertising business across a sort of diversified portfolio. But I'm interested in hearing what the two of you think of that. Are we looking at some growth from Pinterest that's going to be sustained, or since they're, you know, very clearly linking it to the success of their advertising model, or are we going to see, you know, a sort of plateau, an inevitable plateau? Is it going to become a real contender along with other social platforms, because they're talking about the sorts of things that they're inserting into the platform, like shop that look pins and things like that, as being specific sort of ways to get transactions happening on the platform? So are they going to be contenders with other social platforms that are trying to do similar things? Lindsay, let's go to you first, and then Ron.
I think Pinterest still has a huge amount of opportunity available to it. It's been quite a slow burner, but it's really started gaining traction over the past, I would say, probably 6 to 12 months, particularly from the advertiser perspective, where it's made it actually, you know, easier and possible for an advertiser to take advantage of what it has to offer and the users it has, with shoppable ads and shoppable pins and the shop that look thing. Yeah. They're working and it's gaining traction. But I think also what's been interesting about Pinterest from its inception was, I think the user base has gone through is going through a transition. It was largely, I think, mostly female that were using the Pinterest platform, whereas Instagram is completely different,
much more universal,
different demographic,
yeah,
and is able to cater to every kind of person with every type of interest, whereas Pinterest hasn't really done that. And if you are a casual user, like when I moved house, I was using Pinterest to be able to keep track of all the different things that I was demanding that we had in our house.
Yeah.
Or if you're someone that uses it all the time and kind of uses it for mood boards or uses it for kind of any ideas around food, around how to design something, there's many opportunities in that. But there are now more categories available. I think there's talk about, you know, auto, for example. So they are obviously seeing a demographic change. It's not just about, I think of Pinterest. I think of rose gold and marble and unicorns. Genuinely, that's what I think of, because that's all I seem to see. But I think they're trying to get away from, that's what people are thinking of the platform.
Yeah.
And it's going beyond that. So I think there's starting to be an improvement in that. And I think that them introducing advertising into it, you know, it's kind of who's fueling what? Are the advertisers fueling the change, or is it that there's just a new user base and they're going out and trying to find different people and target different people? But I think there's definitely an opportunity. And I think the DTCs, you know, we've talked about DTCs, they'll see an opportunity here as well. That's where there'll be revenue diversification, because that's been a massive area of growth for Facebook, Instagram, and obviously Google as well, from like paid search and everything else. Mm. I think that's where Pinterest will see huge diversification, because they'll want to be able to get in front of that user in the same way they can on Instagram, as long as Pinterest make it easy for them to do. Mm. Because most of these DTCs are still, in the UK anyway, still buying direct. They aren't going through agencies, third parties.
No, self-service. Yeah. They're doing everything themselves. Exactly. Yeah, so it needs to be usable. Yeah. Mm. Ron, what's your point of view?
Well, I mean, the thing with Pinterest for me is it's still very much a U.S. business, right? Mm. So most of their users are in the U.S. and almost all of its revenue, really, right? So, but what I think the last two quarters have shown is that it's a real business, right? It's a billion-dollar company now. So, and advertisers, it's have found that it's quite proven and effective. Now, this is where I agree and disagree with Lindsay, because I think they found a strong, powerful niche, which is, mm-hmm. you know, women creating shopping boards, mood boards, you know, wish lists and things like that. And can they expand that to men, you know, or even, you know, kind of teenagers and stuff like that? It's a possibility. But, they do have kind of a pretty powerful and sizable user base in the U.S. right now. And they're turning it into a shopper experience, and that works. That's a business. Now, I think what you're seeing is they've developed a really strong revenue stream around it, and it's working in the U.S. But I think that what everyone's excited about is there's an opportunity to really scale it, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's adding more people in the U.S. and other demos, or really taking it to Europe, and that's what they're focusing, I think, around right now, mm-hmm. And adding, you know, 10 more countries to their footprint. If you look at their growth, it's untapped in that area. I think it's really an opportunity. I guess the perception is that they can do it now, and the expectation is going to be that they will. Mm. So that's, I think, what the excitement is about. But at the end of the day, it's kind of been slow and steady for them, and that's really, you know, the proven way to grow a business. They've done this step by step, and they haven't necessarily exploded on the scene, but you walk away and come back and everyone's quite impressed with what they've done.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Because they've been around for a long time, Pinterest, right?
Yeah,
when I was
really
reading
have.
This, I was thinking about a conversation I had with a friend of mine who lives in Sydney. I swear it feels like 12 years ago or something, maybe even longer. I don't know. When did Pinterest first start?
I don't know.
And I can remember her. I can remember. 10, 12 years. That's what I thought. And I can
9 years ago, guys.
There we go.
March 2010.
Yeah. And I can remember the conversation because she's quite a creative friend, and she was saying, I'm using this thing called Pinterest to create this, and she was showing it to me. You know, it's exactly the, Ron, you say niche, we say niche. It's exactly the niche that you were talking about. And I remembered looking at it going, oh, that's really cool if you're creative like Carolyn and I'm not. So, you know, I just sort of never really thought about it again. But actually, if they can convert it into something that is, if you like, a visual list of stuff that you might be thinking about, stuff that you either might be thinking about because you're about to purchase it, or you're about to make it, or you're about to create it, and then expand their user base, then that is gold. And like you say, I like the kind of slow and steady approach. Mm. We in this industry, we just hear so much about, you know, exciting new shiny things that get massive cash injections or get bought by somebody with deep pockets, and you know, we all watch their super fast trajectory. It's nice to see a company with a much slower, more steady story to tell.
Doing it the hard way and the right way.
That's right.
Mm. But I do think with Pinterest, you're changing consumers' behavior. It's not something that can happen very quickly. And usually if you want it to sink in and really be an established kind of behavior with consumers, it takes time, right? So you can have like these flash in the pan type things and people get it, but then usually it's more of a fad. Yep. This is really a behavior change, I think, for people. Like, oh, if I want an idea and I want to create a list of things, maybe I can go find people like me who've done this already. And it's really, in my view, it's a, you know, they've now officially said, okay, we've proven that this can work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe we can go take this to, you know, hundreds of millions of other people around the world.
And you could see how it can move over to different categories. I can totally see how it would work in auto and cars, right? What is the difference between a Pinterest? I mean, I know there's a difference, but a Pinterest board and then a car magazine for car enthusiasts. You know, I know a car magazine will perhaps have a lot more detailed, granular information, but it's a similar sort of thing. You could see how that can happen, actually, and they could pick up a whole new set of newsers.
The thing is, for me, it is really about planning and shops and shopping and designing. So it's, for me, how often do you go do car? That's more of kind of like, you know, what, I don't know. For me, that's a tougher one.
Too big a value purchase, perhaps.
I agree with that. I don't think anybody would use Pinterest to create a mood board around cars, but they might use it in the purchase process. Well, so if they're trying to compete with eBay cars, for example.
We'll give you another. So, you know, I have a teenage son and, you know, sneakers. To me, there's like, you know, there seems to be like a cool new sneak kick coming out, you know, every week or two. And I could see that because there are literally companies that are being built on buying and reselling these expensive these rare sneakers. So are there other audiences out there that they can appeal to? Absolutely. I think what's important here, and I think what this is what the earnings report is really based on. Okay, they've tapped into a very large demo, a very important demo, women who kind of build the household, right? And I think that's really for many advertisers, that's a very important demo.
Yeah, right. They're hardcore,
a lot of shopping intent.
Exactly, yeah. And that's they're the gatekeepers of the home, so it's not a bad place to start.
No, exactly. It would just take them 9 years to grow, and then from this they have a great jump off point to build and grow from. Like totally. they've now got they're profitable, they're bringing money in, they've got a hardcore user base. What is next?
Totally.
And maybe not auto.
I don't know. That is one of the new categories.
Yeah, though, I know.
Yeah, that's so. I mean, you know, I was trying to run with that, but I take your point. No one's going to do a mood board about cars.
I'm curious
cars.
To see if it works. Let's
yeah,
put it
yeah,
out.
Yeah. But also, I wonder. You know, I know this is a complete sort of tangent, but I just wonder as well. You know, that what must it be like to work in a company like Pinterest versus, say, a company like I know Snap's having a bit of a renaissance, but you know that experience of working for a company that kind of has an idea. Gets loads of cash, goes public, and then the stock, you know, tanks, and then everyone's just talking about how it's not the latest thing, and then it's on the up again. I mean, what must that experience be like versus slow, steady growth? It's a completely different story, and that must be nice for the people over there working at Pinterest. Yeah, definitely. Cool. Okay, let's move on to the second part of the podcast. Ron, we're keen to chat with you about what you're up to at Heineken and how you're handling and managing your advertising and marketing business.
Right. So, I mean, we've been on a bit of a journey the past, say, 3 years, very specifically about how we advertise to consumers and how we use information to get better and more, I'd say, effective at it. You know, I think we have a good history of being smart marketers, but you know, the world has changed around us, and as things have become more digital and more data centric, consumers have become more expectant in that they're seeing ads that are more relevant to them or content that is curated for them in a sense. And we have to, I think, as marketers, account for that and adjust for that. And that's taken, I think that's taken a pretty significant change in our mindset. And the other is, I think the digital world has made things more challenging for us and harder for advertisers. And we've had to take control of that a bit too. We can't rely on, say, agencies to clean that up for us. I think we have to really as marketers own that and lead that. So I think the past 3 years has been a quite dramatic shift for us in both those areas.
And you were talking before in the prep for this that you're working on a particular initiative around probably incorporates both of those things. So sort of rearranging the business and reorganizing yourselves to be to create that more relevant experience to the advertiser, but also to make sure that you're managing and handling that in house within the company in a particular way. Talk a bit more about that.
Right, so we have a process called IDDM, Individual Data-Driven Marketing, and that's really trying to get the brand teams and marketers, media teams, consumer insights teams to all work closer together and really understand who their customer base is, build audiences that are relevant to the brand and maybe sub-segment them into individual groups or sub-segments that they can talk to more personally and build more direct relationships with. The that's built ideally on good data, and that's, as a company, in the past not been a priority for us, but something is we've kind of, it's been woven through the conversation right here today. But marketers need to have more data so they can, A, understand their consumers better, understand what works and what doesn't work, and really own that relationship better. And that's, you know, I think the DTC opportunity drives, you know, just to, on a tangent, there is a lot of truth to that, right? So by understanding your consumer, what interests them, what they'd like to see, and to be honest, if it works or it doesn't work, sometimes there, you know, the layers between, you know, the retailer, the wholesaler, the FMCG company is, it makes it really hard to understand what's working, what's not working, what's, you know, what are they interested in, what are they not interested in, and because there's so many opinions that sit in between. You know, we want to have this type of product, and but owning a direct relationship with the consumer makes things a lot more real. So I think we've tried to build in now and collect more data on our own in any way, shape, or form that we can. And that's really allowed us to, A, build more audiences, B, potentially build advertising more specific to them, whether it's geolocation or passion point or interest, or whether it's weather-related, all of these different triggers are things that we're experimenting with now.
How has it changed your media mix in terms of versus where you're maybe working with a retailer and you're using kind of, I guess, co-op budget versus what you're doing now and you're building your own audiences, your own data? Has it changed the actual, the strategy behind your advertising as well?
Yeah, the media mix actually has been changing, let's say, for the past 8 years. You know, we were less than 10% digital 8 years ago. Now our media mix is over 30% digital, and it's still, you know, it's not slowing down really. So we're becoming much more digital. I think we're, you know, that's not to say that we necessarily match media consumption behavior, because I think, you know, most research you see, it's, you know, it's even higher than that. But we have to right now go where the effectiveness is, and I think TV is still effective for advertising in many countries, and other out of home is. I will say this. I mean, I think digital allows for personalization, and you have to allows for more data collection and insight. And there's a lot of ability for us to then unlock opportunity there, but the traditional world, whether it's out of home or television, are moving also to an area where you can still have potentially include personalization there as well. So out of home is, you know, and radio were the first kind of retail media out there, right? So I don't think I think we have to look at traditional advertising and traditional media in the same vein of saying, how do we use that more tactfully and personally to pick and choose and direct our conversations with consumers to the right people with the right message at the right time. And that's not something that I think we were necessarily thinking about in the past. The reality is, in a TV world, in a traditional world where you can make one ad that talks to everyone, well, that's really efficient and in the past was still effective. But I think that's in decline. So the reality is digital makes you smarter and allows for things that you can't do potentially in other areas. So we become more digital. It also means that, you know, is Facebook important for us? Yes. Is Google very important for us? Yes. but you know, and programmatic as a whole. So we have a multi-legged stool around it, but that's incredibly complex, right? That's not, you know, each platform, you need different content, you have to customize it. It probably looks different. So, you know, it's fragmented. From a media perspective, we've become more fragmented. And I think what we're now realizing, it from a creative ideation and production, it's also incredibly fragmented. So it's been very hard on brand teams. The media is adjusted, and I think the communication now is adjusted, but there's been a lag to that. And that's what IDDM, I think, has been focusing on, I think, the past year. And we have an IDDM team and leadership within that's working with our different countries and marketers to really kind of accelerate the learning plan around it.
And I was just about to ask, actually, whether that was the IDDM initiative, whether that was sort of led corporately, centrally, or whether that was, something that's set up in a particular part of the business. So there's a team and that operates internationally and it's led at the very senior executive level.
We have a global central team.
Yep.
And what they've done is we've picked a handful of countries to start this with, and then we've rolled it out. But if you look at it, by the end of I think next year it'll be in a majority of our markets and in almost all of our largest markets. So, when we start, we don't necessarily start with all the brands in a country, but we start with a handful, and it expands. Mm. Is it every media dollar that we spend on a brand? No. Is it every campaign? No. But it as we move forward, it continues to grow, and because I think it's a learned behavior. It's a change in behavior. It's a change in how we work as brand people with CMI and media, how we work with our creative agencies and our media agencies. It changes the expectations we have of them in terms of real-time optimization of creative and media buying. So this is it's a different way of working, and we actually literally have an IDDM lead and a team that works with our marketers and brand teams and coaches them. But very quickly, I mean, the truth is it's not rocket science. So if you read David Ogilvy's book that he wrote 50 years ago, I think you'll see that IDDM for us fits in very well with proven marketing and advertising capability, right? It's understanding who your consumers are and your audiences are, the leaky bucket funnel that you're trying to continuously recruit for brands. All of these things are basic marketing principles in a digital world, and that's all that it is. So we have good marketers around the world, we have good brand people, and I think it's just getting them to work closer with the media team to understand what is possible, to look at data and to understand audiences, to optimize based on results when you can in real time. You don't have to wait for the campaign to be over and actually look and see what happened. All these things in the digital world are real and can happen now. So,
and has it impacted? I was going to ask two things. How have you staffed up your IDDM team? Is it all sort of internally from within Heineken, or have you actually recruited externally to get some particular skill sets in there?
Yes.
Okay. That's interesting. So what kind of skill sets were you looking for?
The truth is we have some good marketing talent and media talent and brand talent that have experience around this within Heineken, and we've either brought them to Amsterdam to be a part of the central team, or even moved them around from countries or from the center, from global commerce into countries necessarily. So the reality is the objective is to move people around and move talent around to grow talent, nurture talent, and move them around. And when it came to data, I think that's the area that we did not have a strong
expertise.
No, we don't. And we're not a built to collect data, analyze it and create insights, and potentially then model it, all that. And this, to be honest, that's not just marketing. That sits with, within sales, that sits within our IT department, what we call GIS. All of those areas, over the past 3 years, we've expanded our capability around data, right? So it's not, it's not just media, and which is my area, but almost every area within Heineken, we've had to learn how to be a data company. Mm. That's been led, from very high, from Jan-Dirk von Connerbeck, who's the chief commercial officer within Heineken. He said, we have to become a data company. So, and that's, think over the past 3 years, a quite dramatic change for us.
Do you think that's changing the profile of a sort of a modern marketer, particularly within a big brand or big company organization like Heineken?
It does change. I mean, it changes the skill set a bit, and I think it even potentially changes the structure of your marketing team. And that's we're experimenting with that actually now. Different countries have built different structures around this and how to build marketing organizations in a data-driven world. I think I'm not sure if there's one way to quote unquote skin the cat on this, but we're experimenting with different models and different structures at the moment, and we're finding probably in different countries our business is slightly different as well. So yeah. And maybe here in the UK we own pubs, right? And that's not something we do in many countries. So every country is a bit different. So if you in this case here in the UK, we actually have a tremendous amount of data coming from an area that we don't have in other countries, so we have to leverage that. And the pub business is actually really strong and a great way to collect data.
If you're becoming a data company and kind of everything that fits in with that and the transformation that your business has gone through as a result of that, we talked about, Nike, for example, buying an analytics company. Could you ever see yourselves going down that route of acquiring tech or trying to build your own tech to help manage the nuances that Heineken as a business has when it comes to data, how you manage it, how you process it from market to market versus the tech that might be out there that might not be quite sufficient to your needs?
Yeah, I think we're not averse to going around and acquiring businesses. Again, you're out of my kind of expertise a bit, but obviously we'll say that we have gone the route of maybe acquiring business. I think more in our DNA though is, we have a very entrepreneurial spirit. Mm-hmm. As big as we are, I think at the end of the day, we're kind of still have this DNA of a small family, Dutch family business. But we've done a bit of all of the above. So we've started our own task forces and teams internally. We've created sub companies like Beerwolf here in Europe to do home delivery within the U.S. and we've also gone out and acquired other home draft delivery systems, and whether it's Hopsy, we've done joint ventures and partnerships with other companies. So in a complex world like this, I think we've done a bit of everything to try and understand how to do this fast, how to do this best, and don't always assume that we can do this ourselves. So in some cases, it makes sense to do things internally. In other cases, let's slingshot forward and just bring these other people in with us. So that there's a bit of all of that in here. In the end, I don't think how you get there is what's concerning us as much as more of how we get there faster, better, stronger.
Right.
And that presumably kind of creates a particular type of company culture as well. It sounds like there is an ambition to learn and grow rather than, just sort of skip to the end, as it were. So maybe that informs how you organize things internally and what your strategy is around whether you acquire tech or whether you build your own tech, because actually you're interested in the sort of skill set and the expertise of the people that you've already got in the company and organization.
Yeah, I think that's true. We see the benefit of it, and I think we realize how important it is, but the reality at the end of the day is it needs to work and it needs to drive the growth of our brands and our business. So, and that only happens if you understand it and if you iterate and you learn and you fail and you learn and build off of that. So the one thing about IDDM is not every campaign has been successful. Not everything is executed as we anticipated, right? So part of this is learning, right? Mm-hmm. And it's been quite painful actually. But the reality is at the end of the day is if you don't do it this way, it's there's going to be failures that you don't realize are happening. What we're doing half of IDDM is really understanding what's working, what's not working.
Yeah.
And that's really using more information to make better decisions.
Awesome. Mm. I think we've run out of time, but that was a fascinating conversation. Thanks so much.
That went really quick.
Yeah. It does go quick. Yeah.
It's lots of fun, this Mad Tech podcast. That's why. Thanks so much for coming and joining us in the
really my
in the office
Thanks
today.
Thanks for having me.
Not at all. It was great. That was the Mad Tech podcast.